welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. I'm AD Packham, and we are speaking the language of football in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Well, it feels like a lifetime ago since the final whistle blew in the last game against Watford way back on the 8th of February. Since Adrian Mariappa's comedy own goal gave us a point in that game, we have seen Alexis McAllister touchdown in the UK, and subsequently, expectation on the young Argentinian has ballooned. So, today, we return to action away at Sheffield United, who have surpassed all expectations this season and have European ambitions. Us, on the other hand, have left too many points on the pitch this season and have been guilty of missing too many gilt-edged chances. It really shouldn't be an inflated opportunity for us to blunt the blades. Also this week, we have seen a former Albion player inducted into football's Hall of Fame. Justin Fashanu was more than just a footballer, and his plight highlights a lot of what is wrong with the game today. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares. We welcome back Justin Brintnell. And we will also... And we will also have a chat with Dyke Cunningham. But welcome back to the show, Justin. Nice to see you. How's the season going for you so far?
Started with a lot of promise. Still enjoying the football, just a bit looking down at the bottom of the table, getting a bit worried.
Yeah, it's very much like I said in the intro there. We were leaving way too many points on the pitch.
Definitely, yeah. It looks good, the football. The stats are kind of quite good, but we're not actually converting any of that great play into goals.
Well, stats don't keep you up at the end of the day.
Well, they do if you score more goals than the other team. That's the main one.
That is a really good stat, that one. Yeah.
No, what we've got is that there's too many games where we're just not performing for the 90 minutes. Now, in the Premier League, no one expects you to do so, even if you're one of the top teams. But it's too many games that are games of two halves. Now, the most recent two are Watford and West Ham. West Ham away, absolutely diabolical for the first half. We have to let ourselves go two goals down in order to give ourselves a chance. Then we come fighting back into it and are really, really good. Thankfully, West Ham capitulated. Watford, we were a little bit better, but once they got their goal, they parked the bus. And, you know, this is a team that is in desperate need of scrapping for points, and they'd have been delighted to have come away with one when they're expecting none. But it's an age-old story we talked about. We defend very well. We can beat any midfield. We can go through any midfield. We just cannot score.
Now, Justin, I mean, we're all very much in the Potter camp here. But do you think he's actually tinkering with the side too much? I mean, he's changing it, like wholesale changes a lot, pretty much every game.
I don't, because he's always done that. That's why he was signed. When he would have gone through kind of the... I think it wasn't an interview process. They just went out and got him. But they would have known that's what he does. He's always done it. And that's part of that's part of kind of the Potter handbook. He picks a team to suit that day, that team's tactics. And part of it is that I think the opposition manager finds it very, very difficult, as do we as fans, to have any idea who's going to roll out onto the pitch and what formation they're going to play.
Do you think, though, Al, that a settled side... I mean, that was pretty much Chris Hughton's remit, wasn't it? Putting out a similar 11 every week with the odd change to suit the opposition.
So you've got a settled side or you've got a tinkered side, and people, you know, if the results aren't going your way, then you think, well, that's the problem. It's not necessarily the problem. With Potter, we've said this before, in order for it to work, you've got to have the quality. With Chris Hughton, there was I think too much dogma attached to defending, and not enough to attacking. The fact that we're actually still poor attacking is not down to the fact that, you know, for anyone that says that Graham Potter is too much like Chris Hughton, that's absolute gibberish.
Oh no, that's a load of rubbish. Yeah.
It's total rubbish. I mean, you do see an attacking attempt. Now we've watched the games, and I go back to the West Ham game a couple of games. You know, we've seen that, and you were sort of berating as much as you can from within the press box players not getting into the box. I don't want to have them flooding the box, because, you know, we have been caught out when there's been a 5-6 man breakaway from the opposition, and we get caught. So there is always a fine line. Personally, I don't think the tinkering is that much. The nucleus of the side, the spine of the side, is largely the same.
I do want to see players getting into the box. I mean, you've got the defenders and, defensive midfielders.
But not kamikaze, though.
When you've got players like creating an opportunity, creating a chance, and the ball's coming in, and you're the nearest player to the ball. And we're going to talk about the Watford game in a minute, with particularly our goal. Glenn Murray was nowhere near where the ball went, and there was no one coming into the box. It was absolutely ridiculous.
You've got that.
And it was exactly the same at the West Ham, because you're not going to score if you've got no one at the end of the ball.
Mm. No, I get that. I mean, certainly for the second half of the West Ham game, I think you're being particularly harsh. There were players getting into the box, and that's why we did get the calls and the chaos that we did cause them. They panicked. I mean, West Ham were in full blown panic.
I think Pascal Gross has only just arrived in the West Ham box now. Let's briefly look at Watford. We're not going to go into detail on this one, but I mean, this is my case in point here. There was four changes made to the side that day. And you know, one of them was a surprise to see Dan Burn back so quickly.
But he did okay.
But it was it was what people wanted to see. They wanted to see Shane Duffy instead of Adam Webster.
You said about a settled side. Now, this is an interesting point. You say about a settled side. Dan Burn is clearly one of Graham Potter's first team players.
I think it was a game too soon for him personally.
You don't know. You have no idea. You can't tell. I thought he played okay. He didn't look particularly out of depth. I mean, and if he's ready, if the physios have told him he's ready to go, I mean, once at that point in time, if a broken collarbone was 6 to 8 weeks, we now know with medical science that it's 3 to 4 weeks. Mm. So, you know, and clearly Dan Burn is one of Graham Potter's favoured first, 11. In which case, if he's fit, raring to go, no problem with him playing, get him to play. Because the next game, you say, is one game too soon because he looks a bit ring rusty. No, get him back out there as quickly as possible.
Yeah, maybe. But, I mean, also we had Shane Duffy came in for the beleaguered Adam Webster, which was the call a lot of people wanted to see.
Pans and fires, that one, wasn't it?
Yeah. There was also starting burst for Scalotto and March after their fantastic cameos against West Ham. So, but there was also a Dale Stevens-shaped hole.
There's a couple of points we're going to say here. I mean, let's hear your opinion on this then, Justin. We've got, Webster, I think it's fair to say everyone can realise there's a dropsy in him at least once a game. And then Shane Duffy comes in and sort of, just tries to emulate him quite well. And then the other point that AD's made about Dale Stevens, a number of people, and it, by the way, anyone that says all he ever does is pass sideways and backwards is a liar. What do you maintain, what do you reckon to those points that Dale Stevens is such a linchpin to the midfield, and that Webster, whether it's going to be Webster or Duffy, over to you.
But Stevens thing, interesting enough, AD and I were just reviewing the highlights of the Watford game, and there's the moment where Moy grabs the ball and he's kind of heading forward, and he kicks the ball and it deflects off a player, and I think AD said, well, it's not his fault, and I said, well, actually, if it was Stevens, he would have turned around and passed it to the defender and we wouldn't be 1-0 down. So I think he's very good at doing what he does. I think I think you need a player like that in every team. Saying that, I thought when we played Spurs, we had Alzate was playing kind of right at the back in kind of a almost a defensive midfield position. So we may well see that tomorrow. But yeah. Stephen, that solidity of Stevens wasn't there. Going back to the Duffy Webster thing, I think Duffy can play football, but I don't think he can play Potter ball.
What do you mean by that?
Well, he's a fantastic defender, certainly in the air. Last season, he was awesome, sort of under Houghton, where we're very much kind of backed against the wall. But I don't think. A lot of our players don't seem to have the confidence to pass him, whereas they do pass to Webster. Webster keeps the ball moving. When it comes to Duffy, you can just see, and he's got the ball, and it's kind of right, what are you going to do now? And everyone's kind of thinking,
You think there's an error of hesitation there.
But then his defending is so good. You kind of want to mash them together and create some sort of Van Dijk hybrid that will be the player to kind of get us out of that, and potentially next season that's going to be Ben White. But at the moment, if I was Potter, I'd stick to my guns, and only if I was playing a team of kind of big bullies would I have Duffy in. But if we're playing teams that are kind of playing maybe with the more kind of the prettier football and the less kind of hustle and bustle. I'll have Webster in there because I think he just adds so much sort of attacking intent and movement and the possible thing, and all players are comfortable passing to him, and he's comfortable with the ball.
Okay, well, I mean, in this particular game, there was, there was a big change in the dynamic when Alzati did come on, and he did play that Dale Stevens role very, very well.
But Dale Stevens is the one who plays that Dale Stevens, because Davy Purple is the one who was playing it initially. And I just thought he played it very poorly, very lazily, because Purple is a quality player. He can pick a pass. He can. He plays sometimes the high risk pass, which when it doesn't come off, he'll lose the ball and we're 1-0 down. But if it does come off, he'll make another player look really stupid. But what he didn't do so much against Watford, which Dale Stevens does, and it's again one of those ridiculous. How many times? How long has Stevens been with us now? Is it 6 years? And he still hasn't been noted for actually going out there onto the pitch. But he's the one who makes himself available. Now, with Graham Potter's style, it's about the pass. It's one thing the person who is passing, whether it's Dunk, whether it's Webster, whether it's Scalotto or Montoya at right back, it's knowing the recipient is ready to receive it. And far too often, especially in the Watford game, and this is where you can see the difference between what Proper and Stevens can do, is Proper did not make himself available half as much as Stevens knew how to. And in that sense, that's why it was so much easier for Watford to close us down. Now, Stevens might then actually just pass the ball back. He might pass it sideways, but by the same token, what it does is it gives Watford another problem, a problem that they didn't have because he wasn't playing and Purple wasn't doing the things that Stevens would have been doing.
And there you have it, a classic example of a player not playing, getting his reputation enhanced. But yeah, I mean, I agree with all of that, basically. I mean, he does the dirty stuff that no one likes to see. He does the unseen work, yeah, the donkey work, and keeps it ticking over. And it's such an important role. Let's face it, he has had a blip this season.
Everyone's had a blip this season.
But let's look at the other end of the pitch, though. That's two games in a row that Glenn Murray started on his own.
You can hear him creaking.
Yeah,
I think he's nothing like as isolated as he was last season. I mean, the ball would just get walloped up to him, and there'd be no one within the sort of the same football pitch as him, which was largely what it was against West Ham for the first half. And then you realise you just change it around a bit, get the players a bit closer to him, and he's a lot more effective. And he was an absolute. I know we've talked about West Ham already, but he was a total bully in the second half against West Ham, and again they panicked. That's what he's there for. Maybe he'll do it against Sheffield United because, you know, with all due respect to them, it's not as though we should be beating teams like them. You know, they are a team that's set up to put you off your game. Mm. I won't say they play this anti-football because, you know, if they really did, then they would have been sussed by now.
I mean, well, we didn't play Glenn at all against Sheffield United at home. And, you know,
that's not to say he's the answer.
Well, he's not the answer. But when you're playing against a team like that, that are going to bully you, they are going to close you down. You want a player who can actually do the same back to them. And Glenn is part and parcel of that player. Okay, I mean, it was there was a couple of other... I mean, there was we looked at the Schelotto penalty. I mean, do we think it was?
Nope.
No. Okay, we'll move on from that. Watford looked really worried every time the ball came in from the right in this game, and we didn't do that often enough. I mean, Schelotto, he can't beat a man. He does worry me a little bit.
Hang on, is that his first and foremost? I mean, you said yourself about players playing in the right positions. You know, he's not a flying winger. He's not someone who gets the byline. And is, I mean, Bruno could, but that's because he always had Knockout, you know, playing alongside him. Which incidentally is not my my treatise for having Knockout back, but I'd be concerned about a right back who wants to go flying past their man every time. So the point of whether they get past their man is not the point; it's the quality of the ball that comes in.
But he did put in that quality ball, and again, there was no one on the end of it. No, this you kind of think that you want someone with. Alongside Glenn with a bit more legs.
Yeah,
I'd like a Morpo or a Connolly. I think.
But if you're going to put a cross in, then the likes of Mopai and
this wasn't Connolly. A cross. This was an angled drive across the face of the box. It just needed a touch.
Mm. Oh, that I thought was a dreadful shot, actually.
No, it wasn't a shot. It was definitely a cross. Aaron Moy nearly scored a brilliant goal in this game. A wonderful exchange of passes between Alzati, Morpai, and so Moy through a goal.
You're
but
asking
Benton's...
a lot for us to remember this game, mate.
Well, we just watched it. We're all right. All right. It just seemed like an absolute lifetime ago. I mean, what do you make of this break, Justin?
I thought it was a bit bizarre. I hadn't properly cottoned on to it, and I'm kind of thinking, when's the next home game? It's, oh my gosh, when's the next away game? And it's a bit. Various teams have gone off and done training camps abroad, haven't they? And
I think we postponed a trip to Dubai or something like that.
Yeah,
we were going to do that. And where did they end up? Butlins, was it? Or?
I don't know.
You just feel a hot air there.
Well, yeah, it's just, you know, it's a bit like they're shooting. It was just ballooning everywhere.
Yeah, I think everything was a bit blown up about that whole thing.
Wherever, I'm sure they had a gas, but anyway. Alireza Jahanbakhsh, his first assist for the Albion, and it was a brilliant finish from Marietta.
Can you have an assist when it's an own goal? Does it count?
Yeah, of course you do, because it's basically he's putting the ball in the danger area again from the right.
Well, it wasn't a danger area because there was no one there.
Exactly, it's comedy, but you know, we'll take it. I mean, again, it's another game.
Can I just say that actually, and we're not allowed to swear on this radio show, and it's such a shame it is. But to see Nigel Pearson's face and his reaction when that own goal went in was a treat. And so it was actually worth another goal.
It was Murray's nickname, wasn't it? What he said?
Thanks, something like that. Yeah.
See, I think you've got to credit Glenn Murray with that goal because it's actually his reputation, and the defender would have been thinking, it's Glenn Murray. He's going to be behind. He's going to be in the right place at the right time. The fact that he was closer to the halfway line than he was
that's a hell of a reputation.
But it's the fact that there was, you know.
And Pamela Anderson was running alongside him. Yeah, I know.
Mariappa looked terrified when that. But he was scared to death. He didn't know what to do. And the only thing he could do was fall on his sword and give us a go. He was so frightened of what might happen.
I mean, Alireza, he's coming to the party a little bit more at the moment.
Well, he is fine. It's about time. I mean, he's still not the big answer. And it'd be interesting to see what this McAllister does. I'm sure we'll talk about him presently.
Yes, we will. But first, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com on DAB. And of course, on our podcast, I'm AD Packham, and we are here in association with OldFootballShirts.com, as is Alan Wears and Justin Brintnell. And I have a shirt of the week for you. I'm actually going to give this to Justin, because I know you know what it is, Al. So,
oh, do I? Oh, right, yes.
So okay. if you can just describe this particular jersey for our listening person.
Yeah, so this is a the main colour is purple, and then there is kind of what appears to be about a 5-inch stripe made up of all the colours of the rainbow, going from kind of the neck all the way down to the bottom. It's got black and white, small black and white kind of stripe trim on the sides.
Who's the make of the kit?
Hummel. And they're just looking at the badge now, which is normally a bit of detail there that gives the game away.
Has he photoshopped it out again?
I think he probably has. I don't think I can get that. Have I got a guess who's it is?
I can't remember who. I actually can't remember who it is, but can I just say that before AD does, excuse me, read out who it is. Well, it was on the back of a WhatsApp discussion we have. Now, Phil is quite the anorak when it comes to... football kits, if you excuse me.
He should start a website, shouldn't he?
Well, yeah, who knew? Yeah, who knew?
How many? And he was 106,000, I think.
Yeah, it is nearly 106,000. And he was talking about specifically Hummel kits, and obviously talking about the Denmark one of the 80s and 90s. There was Southampton, and there was the Spurs had one. There was a whole load of others.
And one of them was a handball kit.
And one of them was I think that's how it was. It was a German handball team saying, you know, Hummel do this.
It was the St. Pauli handball team.
Right, okay. Have you worked out who the badge is yet, Justin?
I haven't. I'm guessing that it's not a team from Eastern Europe, because I'm assuming the rainbow is LGBT.
Wouldn't last 5 minutes.
Q+.
Put him out of his misery, AD.
Okay. Oh, well, here is your shirt of the week, says Phil. And it's by popular demand. He says it's a blinder from the newly effervescent Hummel. And this is the 2015 to 2016 home shirt of Spanish side Deportivo Guadalajara. And they play in the Tercera division, which is, of course, the fourth tier of Spanish league football.
He's been practising.
The Tercera is split into 18 regions covering all of the mainland of Spain, as well as the island groups. And Guadalajara play in the Castilla-La Mancha region, which is pretty much the centre of the country, excluding Madrid, who have their own region. Known as DG, they were formed in 1947 and they play at the 8,000 capacity Estadio Pedro Escatan. And Pedro Escatan was the former footballer. He played for Real Sociedad, Gimnástica, Española, before health reasons forced him to retire, and he went on to become a renowned referee. In fact, the first Spanish referee at a World Cup, and he then tried his hand at management as the coach of the Spanish national side. I knew you thought I'd find a link to the UK, but if anyone thought I wouldn't find a link back to the Albion, you underestimate me, says Phil.
Oh, come on, he makes them up anyway.
Former Guadalajara centre-forward and Scotsman Ryan Harper has played his entire career in the Spanish lower divisions. His younger brother, Jack Harper, spent two seasons with the Albion youth team after signing for us from Real Madrid in 2015. He never made a first-team appearance and in 2017 signed for Malaga and subsequently now plays for Alicorn on loan in the Segunda division. Who else do we know that played for Alicorn? Who we signed from there? Can you remember?
That would be the only person that springs to mind maybe is Ochoa.
No, it was David Rodriguez,
Spanish Rod. But yeah, that is quite a handsome shirt. It's a really nice sort of mauve shirt with a rainbow stripe straight down the middle. And I think it's just those on our particular WhatsApp group were just sort of salivating over that a little bit. And yeah, it's a very nice shirt. And it will be up on our social media sites and is also on Phil's 106,000 strong oldfootballshirts.com. Thanks very much indeed, Phil. Well, as some of you know, February is Football v Homophobia month. Football v Homophobia is actually a properly set up awareness campaigning structure set up by Pride Sports based in Manchester. But it covers an umbrella of organisations that are unique to every given club across the country, especially in the Premier League. With that in mind, I'm delighted to say that we're joined by Di Cunningham, organiser of Proud Canaries, who, as the name implies, she's a massive Norwich City fan. Di, can you hear me?
I can. Good evening.
Hiya, welcome to the Albion Raw. Thanks very much indeed for coming on. We've had so many conversations on Twitter and text and what have you, and finally we get to speak to each other. Are you well?
I'm very well indeed. A little bit tired. It's been a busy week, but yeah, feeling good.
I can imagine about that, because we'll get to that in a minute as to what you've been doing, because I know that you've been very busy. But first and foremost, tell us about Proud Canaries. In fact, tell us about the Proud Football Fan Network across the country.
Yeah, so we set up in 2013, and we were in 2013, there were two LGBT plus fan groups. One was Gay Gooners and the other one was us. And kind of after that, a number of other LGBT plus fan groups started forming at other clubs, and now there are 40. There are over 40, in fact, and some in Scotland as well. And the idea, I think originally the idea, particularly for Gay Gooners, was to be a social group, really, just to kind of hang out with other lesbian, gay, bi and trans fans at home and away. But for us, it was quite political. There were a few of us who were involved with Norwich Pride, who were also big Norwich City supporters. And we were conscious that, lovely as Carrow Road is, sometimes it's not. And it depends where you sit. And I had to listen to some guys behind me, also season ticket holders, so it was, you know, every home game, who were routinely homophobic or just using homophobic language. And, you know, for a gay fan, that is quite difficult. You can't, and you just, I don't know, I just soaked it up. You know, it's always been part of football in a way, hasn't it? The slurs, and you hear them regularly.
We do. When you say homophobic, it's chanting, I mean, or stuff, is it just sort of like regular
chit-chat?
Not really
chanting. It's just like a mumble, really. It's just like using words like fag, and that's so gay, kind of willy-nilly, just interchanging them. And And then, you know, there are the branding away supporters. You know, it's not just you guys who get branded.
Yeah,
it's like,
absolutely.
You know, nonce and gay and, you know, there's been the conversation this week about the Chelsea Rent Boy chant as well. So it's just like something in football that is about demeaning the opposition, whether it's calling them, you know, girls, like she fell over, or gay, you know, as if that's a symbol of weakness.
So it's using gender inequality to actually try and get one up on. I mean, we've had Louise Englefield from Pride Sports, from Football Behind Homophobia,
yes.
come on and say exactly the same thing. It is all about the language of gender politics, some of which include using you know, effeminate terms to describe, you know, the sort of lack of I don't know, quality or the lack of effort put in by a given player.
Yes, it's kind of branched out though now, hasn't it? So with the is it Firmino at Liverpool being told that he has a lesbian haircut. So I don't know whether that's...
What's a lesbian haircut?
I think
I might
like
have one.
Lots of... I do pretty much. Yeah. It's a pretty short crop with kind of clippering going on, going on. Yeah. So I don't know what that says in terms of... I don't know, in terms of gender politics. But what we discovered was that, you know, so we were working with the club to sort out things like signage and steward training and a kind of coordinated steward response to different situations. Mm. But that's kind of like, you know, I think what we found is actually the kind of German method of fan family stuff and fan culture works far better than people being told what to do by their club. I mean, at the end of the day, you need the police and the stewards mm-hmm. for the real hard cases.
Yeah.
But
majority of it's kind of self-policed, isn't it?
It is. And it's like people aren't just not thinking and they've had a little bit too much to drink and they behave the way they think football fans are supposed to behave. And that probably involves a little bit of homophobia. And, you know, for some people at some clubs, a little bit of racism. And they just need to learn that's not OK. So we have worked really well with the club, but mainly with the other fan groups. So, you know, with the bloggers, with the... just, you know, the social club with the different, you know, there's a real fan culture group called Along Come Norwich and the Barclay End mm-hmm. and working with them and everybody retweets stuff and you're mainly seeing, like, we are mainly seen as just a fan group who have opinions about how the club play, how the team are playing and how the club's run. But incidentally, we happen to be LGBT. So,
I've got to cut across you there because obviously you've kind of got a very sort of well-structured set of fan groups going on there. I mean, for instance, at Brighton, we get the homophobic abuse, but with all due respect to Stuart Matthews and the group he's got, the Proud Seagulls isn't a large group and it's not a particularly vociferous group. So maybe it doesn't need to be. Maybe here we're pushing an open door, but in other places, you know, and I can't comment on them, though I do consider somewhere like the City of Norwich to be a fairly progressive city and Norwich City itself to be a progressive club is that you have this sort of collection of fan groups, but is there a smack of tokenism that there is the Proud Canaries, or is it something that it does need to be there?
I think that may well be the case at some clubs. I'll tell you one club is definitely the case, is Manchester United, where if you know, you look at all the followers that Manchester United has on social media and their different fan groups, and then you look at, I think it's called Rainbow Devils, you look at their profile on Twitter and it's barely got any followers, and it's essentially a shell. I think it's there because they're trying to kind of pretend in a way that they've got a group, but it doesn't interact with the other fan groups as far as I know, the other LGBT plus fan groups. Ours certainly isn't tokenism. I mean, we are first and foremost a bunch of fans. Mm-hmm. We've got a kind of every year we take part in the, in fact, I think it's going to be the Brighton match, which is the Global Canaries Pitch Parade. Mm. So, you know, there'll be like New York Canaries there. There'll be, I don't know, Peterborough Canaries, there'll be Scottish Canaries and Proud Canaries and the Disabled Canaries group as well. Mm-hmm. So it's like a mixture of different interests and different geographic areas represented. And we go on the pitch with our banner and there have been every year we have about 30 people, and that's not the same people. You know, people are fighting to get on the pitch and go round. Mm. We've got like, I would say 80 probably active members. Mm. And then we've got like 2,000 followers on Twitter. So it's certainly not tokenistic, and it's very visible. So sure. I think that's what we've found. It's like,
are you taken seriously? Are you taken seriously as a group?
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
I think that's the important point, isn't it? Is that you've got the group in itself, and it's just not just a sop. It's not, you know, because when you have to, you're battling against, generations long ingrained attitudes and
yes.
supposed male working class attitudes.
I mean, you can see how things have changed. The first year we did the pitch parade, so that was 2014, just after we'd formed in 2013. And somebody, I didn't hear this, but lots of people did, and some of the people parading did. Some guy shouts out, can I swear on this podcast?
Please don't, no. Because you will be on the radio.
Ah, okay, it's the proper radio. Okay.
Yes.
One guy shouts, don't clap them, shoot the...
Yeah.
Word beginning with F and ending in S.
Yes.
And this got reported on social media, and there was kind of outcry, really. But it had happened, and that represented somebody who was a regular fan.
Yeah.
They got dealt with straight away. They were identified. Chief exec got them in the office.
Were they shot? Were they shot themselves?
I think there were tears, and I think they were on a final warning, and
right.
nothing like that has happened since. And whenever there's any homophobia on Twitter from other fans, perhaps from the Ipswich geographic area, our own fans close it down. We don't have to do that anymore. And the year that you guys went up to the Premier League,
yeah.
I think we played you three times. Did we play in a friendly that season?
That sounds
as well?
About right. Yeah. Yeah.
So, and we monitored the number, or the presence of homophobic chanting against you that season. So I think in the first game, in the friendly, there would have been, because there would have been people coming to the game who don't normally come to the game, and you get that ridiculous, folks thinking that's novel and no one's
we've heard every single one of
you.
Them. Actually, in that case, let me put this back on you, because I do need to move this on a little bit, but let me put this back on you, because this particular response does actually, it splits ideals amongst the LGBT community, is the response, which is, our response is, you're too ugly to be gay.
Yes.
I'd be curious as to what you personally would think of that as a response.
Yes. I mean, this is interesting. I've had the conversation with Attila, the Stockbroken Oaths Big Brighton fan, about this, and I thought it was hilarious.
Yeah.
I had a bit, and you've got various other responses.
Yeah. You'll never know till you tried it.
Yeah. What I have a problem with is, before you had Proud Seagulls, in those responses, I think, on the whole, there was still an underlying assumption that there was nobody actually gay in the stadium.
Mm.
So the responses are essentially from straight people back, aren't they? But now I think, you have got that visibility. And it doesn't matter, in a way, how big a group is. If you've got a regular visibility on social media and in the stadium by some kind of banner, even if it's not there all the time, nobody can believe that there is nobody LGBT in the stadium. And then it makes it more difficult sing those songs.
Well, there is that. But there is the other thing that comes up, and I'm sure it happens with other clubs, when they change their banners on social media, and they'll put in the background, they'll put in the rainbow flag in the background.
Yes.
Now, for instance, we've got players from given countries who obviously have fans. I mean, and this is kind of what we found interesting when we got to the Premier League, just what a global thing it is. I mean, we
yes.
saw it's this ridiculous worldwide thing. And so we've got players from other countries whose followers themselves, whose nationality don't necessarily tolerate homosexuality,
yes.
or indeed in some countries where it's frowned upon, it's illegal, or it's punishable by death.
Yes.
And so so the response we get from that, from people in given countries, in given cultures, is to be mortified, to be horrified,
and to be
swearing, and to be horrible, and sort of, and our attitude is, well, if you don't like it, we didn't sort of stick a gun to your head and ask you to be a fan of this club. You're a fan of this club because of X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
You know, and it's it's a very much a cultural thing that, you know, in for the most part, you know, in Western culture, in Western Europe, that this sort of thing is openly accepted and not just tolerated, but openly accepted and supported.
How brilliant a channel is football to have that reach,
yeah,
and to have and to start that conversation. Because, you know, somebody kind of steeped in those cultures, if in countries where the law doesn't offer any protection to the LGBT plus community, and you know, the religion dictates that homosexuality is sinful. For somebody to kind of be awakened, if you like, for the first time by football, and yeah, maybe have that initial response, but that's a kind of starting point, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And so I just love that football, you know, can change that. And I'm trying to wind up this conversation, but I'm also part of Three Lions Pride, the England LGBT plus supporters group, and we went to Russia for the World Cup, and we'll go to Qatar for the World Cup as well. And you know, I think we need to use our privilege. We will be safe, you know. We had FIFA looking after us in Russia, making sure that the banners stayed up, and that at least in the stadiums we were safe. And so, you know, we have a right, a responsibility to use that exposure, and to use the power of football.
Now, it's interesting you use the concept of the saying that football can be a force for good, and yet, and I've written about this myself this week. We still only have ever had one male professional footballer come out as gay across all of Western Europe ever within the top few divisions. There's a few in the lower divisions, the semi-professionals, the amateur leagues. But let's face it, obviously we're talking about Justin Feshnew here, a player for Norwich, probably better known at Norwich than when he was at Brighton, but very much appreciated at Brighton. And I said at the top of this part of the show that February is Football v Homophobia Month, I think principally because of that was the birthday of Justin Feshnew. And you attended a very special ceremony this week, didn't you?
I did. I was invited to the National Football Museum in Manchester, which has the Football Hall of Fame for this country, and invited to speak just before Justin was inducted posthumously to the Hall of Fame.
What was the citation? Was there specifically a citation as to why he was indicted into it? Was it, you know?
Well, they've changed the criteria. I think probably the wording is the same, so it's about an outstanding contribution to football. But up until recently, it's been pretty monocultural and pretty kind of a bias to male footballers as well, I suppose, understandably. But it's also been about a kind of enduring talent. A stellar career in football. So Justin's career wouldn't have reflected that, because although, you know, he scored the stunning goal against Liverpool, and that goal of the season 40 years ago here at Carrow Road, and he had some other wonderful performances. I think one of the I hadn't seen it before, but one of the stunning Justin moments was playing for Hearts against Atletico Madrid.
Right.
So he had various absolutely delightful moments and clearly fantastic skills. But his career was blighted by injury to an extent.
Yes.
But hugely by the fact that he came out as gay. And even if he hadn't come out, I think it still would have been blighted, because before he came out, he was bullied homophobically by his manager at Nottingham Forest.
Absolutely.
And people apparently at West Ham, and I imagine elsewhere, he played for over 20 clubs, so he obviously didn't settle anywhere.
No.
He was at your place for quite a while, though, wasn't he?
He was here for a couple of years, but he only played 16 times for us. Again, he was injured for most of that time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was appreciated and fondly remembered.
He had players climbing out of the communal bath when he got in at West Ham, apparently.
Right.
And that kind of thing. So, you know, he was an incredibly tough character to deal with that. But yeah, I mean, surely if he'd been in an age where, like, not this age either, but an age where it was possible to be out as a footballer. So, you know, it's a good thing to come out, because you can perform better at what you do. Athletes are going to be better at being sports people if they don't have to worry about hiding who they are. So coming out is supposedly a good thing.
Well, that's the theory, isn't it? But I mean, it does raise. I'm sorry to say, we don't have a huge amount of time to debate this, but
yeah,
it does actually raise the spectre again, and as to why there hasn't been a male professional footballer come out now. The attitude that a lot of people come up with, and I understand this to a point, is that someone's sexuality shouldn't matter. It's not of anyone's business, and I get that to a point. But we don't live in a vacuum. We don't live in a social or cultural vacuum, and because there hasn't been one, there is a reason for it. Now, I'm sure that I think that the vast, vast, vast majority of fans are far more enlightened than certain aspects of those who run football. And I'm including the players' union, I'm including the chairman, I'm including the authorities here, are just not so enlightened.
Yes. Do you know what? I think things have changed. And the FA, I know the wheels turn very slowly, but the FA and the leagues and most clubs have made some kind of provision. There's a kind of a kind of bat phone somewhere that will ring if, a footballer is thinking of coming out, and then the kind of troops all get together and manage it with, counselling available and support mechanisms at the club. I can imagine some clubs are more geared up than others. So that's kind of in place. My feeling is that there are a few things that probably, as there were in Justin's day still, like a fear of dressing room culture, not necessarily at the club that you're at now, but you might get moved to a club, in a day, mind you. You might get moved to one of those a club in one of those countries you mentioned where it's illegal to be gay. And you might have an agent who's suggesting that it's not a good thing. Agents might not be as up to speed as everybody else is.
I mean, it wouldn't be a particularly good agent that sends someone off to sort of, Eastern Europe where, they're not quite as enlightened.
But surely a smart agent is going to realise that there are sponsors out there who would, absolutely love a male footballer to come out and get them on the catwalk.
I think a lot of us would, but also, I don't think any of us, I'm not LGBT at all myself, but I cannot put myself, in a position of being within society generally of being LGBT, and certainly not any of us can put ourselves within that kind of, microscope of being a professional footballer.
Yes.
In that, and
that's changed,
it's a head scratcher, isn't it? Yes, but listen,
Justin had to deal with the Sun,
but anyone still does now,
but he didn't have to deal with social media, and I think that's the big problem.
I really do.
You just have to think about
because
Philip
it's so much
Schofield.
More internationalist as well,
and that goes all over the world. And it's Philip Schofield, Caroline Flack just this week, and if you kind of put those two together, it does reflect kind of the torment that Justin had and still in 2020. I think we have to rely on a youngster coming out in an academy before they're in the media spotlight.
That's an interesting point. Again, the nature of education, how it's been for those of us who are sort of, past their half century, and those who are younger, that the younger you go, the better the education you like to think is going to be. Listen, Di, I'd love to carry on chatting, and please do come back on the Albion Roar, especially when...
I'd love to.
Especially when you're
downhill. I'm really looking forward to seeing you, folks.
Absolutely.
It's April, isn't it?
I think that sounds about right. So, yes, we'll come and find you. But in the meantime, thank you very much, Di Cunningham, organiser of the Proud Canaries. But also talking of April, that brings us to the two-legged Renf game. I'll come to the quiz in a minute, but brings us to the two-legged Renf game we've got coming up. April 24th at Croydon FC, it's Crystal Palace supporters against Brighton Hove Albion supporters in the first of two legs for the challenge match this year. The return leg being on Friday the 15th of May at Woodside Road in Worthing. I'm sure they've got a sponsor's name for their ground, but I'm not going to call it whatever it is because I don't care. It's going to be a fiver to get into each game. All proceeds go to the Robert Eaton Memorial Fund. It'll be a hoot. Looking forward to both legs. So if you're going along April 24th and May the 15th. We also have way before that, we have Friday the 13th of March. That's coming up on us very, very quickly. Is we have the 10th annual Robert Eaton Memorial Fund Quiz Night at the Mayo Wynn Baxter Lounge at the Amex Stadium. It's a five per person to enter. Teams of up to six. Teams of up to six is just to answer the question that most commonly gets asked. pay on the night. And if you want to know more, just email me, alan.wares@ntlworld.com. And, you know, and happily enter your team into the quiz night. And the week before that, AD.
Yes, the week before that, we mentioned this a couple of weeks ago. It's the Reverbathon again. What is the Reverbathon? Radio Reverb, basically, it's run by on Fresh Air and Enthusiasm, and we need money to pay for licenses, electricity, and just generally keeping the station going.
Your coke
and,
habit.
Yeah. Diet Coke, please, yeah. Sunday, March the 8th, we're having the annual Reverbathon. This year it's going to be slightly different. It's always a bit mad.
Yeah.
But this year you can actually come and watch us.
No, more than watch us, mate.
Listen to us.
Join in.
Well,
as long as it's not abusive and obnoxious.
I haven't written it yet. Give me a chance.
Who knows?
But yeah, so on Sunday, the 8th of March, we are going to be live from
1 till 2.
We've got the 1 till 2 slot. At the Hope and Ruin. Which is on Queen's Road in Brighton. Radio Reverb, we're going to be broadcasting live from there all day. So come along, join in, have fun. There's some really, really, really good DJs and presenters.
Radio Reverb is so diverse in all the product it puts out there. We've got a nice little reversal this time. We're actually following Mark Johnson's slipstream, so we're going to take over from him. So we're going to ruin his afternoon.
So we're going to be in his slipstream.
And I think Melita Dennett takes over from us. But the main thing about it is raising money for Radio Reverb, and you can do that if you want your name shouted out there. If you want your company name shouted out there, please do put yourself forward as a sponsor for the day. We're after £40 per company. For that, you'll get a big shout out on the show. We do it on social media. You'll be loved forever to show that you actually are supporting this brilliant community asset. So if you want to do that, either get a hold of AD or get a hold of myself.
Yeah, so please contact us at thealbionraw@yahoo.co.uk. And
just to say, we already have two people doing that. I've got to say thank you to Dan Maskell, Financial Planning, and thank you to David Costa of Flowers Unlimited, who have done just that. This is brilliant, and the more the merrier. So if you know of people who feel like contributing, or you can do it as an individual donation, just go to radioreverb.com/donate and throw in all your wages. We'd be loving to have it. So
I'm not gonna lie, I'm absolutely petrified about this one.
Why?
Molly's coming. My daughter, my 7-year-old daughter.
I think sensibly not till 2 o'clock, Aidan.
Yeah, and she is my biggest heckler and my biggest fan.
No, I'll be your biggest. We'll heckle. Please. Justin will come along and he can heckle. You know,
I can heckle.
Yeah, just throw beer at me.
So anyway, so that's the reason we're doing it on the Sunday is we won't be doing our regular show on the Saturday. Radio Reverb is giving up its entire outside broadcast. Well, it's taken up an outside broadcast. It's given its entire output for the day for the International Women's Day, broadcasting live from the Brighton Museum, where they've got a fantastic women's portraiture exhibition going on there. There'll be doing that from there. So Saturday is we're giving up our Saturday slot in order to do Sunday. So it's going to be a brilliant weekend for Reverb. It's going to be a brilliant weekend for us. So please come and support us.
Okay, Justin, news broke this week. I mean, we can't really put too much meat on the bones on this because we don't know too much about it yet. But it looks like there is going to be an expansion of the Amex. Now, you live in the Falmer parish, as it were. What do you know about it and what do you think?
I wasn't at the parish meeting where there seems to be some discussion about it, but yeah, having read a bit, it just looks like the club has decided to do sort of a final push to fill in the odd gap, I think, and just get as many in now as they possibly can. I think it's going to rely on maybe tweaking the transport plan, but they took about 2,000, I think, which they're probably going to have to do something big to get that number. I'd imagine maybe the North Stand extending that backwards or putting a shelf in or something. But I think it's, if they've got the justification, seems to be the waiting list of 8,000. So and it seems they're going to do it whether we're Premier League or Championship. So yeah, I think it's good news. More people that can watch the club, the better.
Yeah, Al.
I've got to be honest with you, this is actually news to me. I know the grown-ups at the club have been talking for a long time about, you know, eking this seat here and maybe sort of, you know, narrowing this seat there and maybe sticking it on top of someone's head here and there. And 2,000 does sound an awful lot to put in. That is another 6% on top of the on top of the current capacity.
Well, they reckon it will generate another 750,000 in revenue a year.
Well, so. Therein lies that's the math that has to be done, is how much is the work going to cost versus what is the cost on return?
Unless, of course, I mean, we know that the club have actually carried out a study on this.
I'm sure they have. But
with the rail seating, maybe that's an option.
No, because that's going to be a one-on-one. Maybe get rid of the Heineken Lounge because, you know, now that we've outgrown it for the quiz night, you know, they don't need it anymore.
It's still the best lounge, Al.
It is a very nice lounge, actually.
It is the best one. It's the one that's got the most... It's the most human lounge, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and this is
a
Dutch Largo lounge, isn't it?
Yeah.
No, I like the Heineken lounge. To be honest, I'd be interested to see, like, as you say, more meat on the bone. So.
Yeah. Okay, well, if one day when they let Martin Perry retire, we'll...
Fat chance.
Yeah.
I think they're just trolling. I don't think there's this plan to do it at all. I think they're just trolling Martin Perry to keep him there for another year.
Okay, well, today we head to Sheffield United to face. Are they overachieving, Justin, the Sheffield United side? Or you were very impressed with them?
Yeah,
the moment,
no, I think they're the best team I've seen at the Amex this season. Okay. I don't think they're overachieving at all, and I think it is organisation and tactics. When they were at the Amex, I thought they outnumbered us across the pitch all the time. They controlled the game. We were playing football exactly where they wanted us to play football. It looked like each time one of our players had it, they were outnumbered about 3-1. I think tactically, Wilder just destroyed Potter. Hopefully, Potter will get his magic wand out and come up with some sort of bizarre tactic today to actually swing that back. Yeah. And the good thing, I suppose, is that Sheffield United do sort of turn up and do what it says on the tin. So they will come along and play 3-5-2. It will be their normal tactics. So what can Potter pull out the magic hat?
Well, maybe an Argentinian or maybe a new fullback, perhaps. I mean, I don't know if you saw this. This was genius. I mean, Graham Potter's probably not known for his sense of humour.
Well,
he probably would thank me for saying that. But he did come out with a brilliant line today, which was what does Lamptey do? What difference will he bring to the side? Well, he said, against Dan Byrne, about 3 foot. Because apparently they've been playing together. He's been pulling up against each other. I mean, I'd like to see Lamptey. I think this might be a little bit too simple.
Of Mark McCowan and Leon Knight, then?
Yeah, a little bit like that. But anyway, I've got a little bit of a Sheffield United quiz for you.
Oh, deep joy.
Ooh. I know. I hope
one of these is wrong.
Yeah, I know you do. But okay, the first question is, who was the last player we signed from the Blades?
Murphy.
It was Jamie Murphy. Well done.
Okay, hang on. You two were chatting earlier, weren't you?
No, he's not seen any of this.
All right, go on.
Okay, who scored our last goal against Sheffield United?
Leon Knight?
No. The last goal against Sheffield United. It was at Bramall Lane. I'll give you that.
Bobby Zamora.
It was not Bobby Zamora. It was in a 3-1 defeat. If you want a clue, I'll give you the date.
Which was
the 21st of January 2006.
Dean Hammond.
It was not Dean Hammond.
Go on.
Forster?
Colin Kazim Richards.
All right.
You'll
never make a quiz and ask them, mate.
Okay, the game with Dean in 2002 was marred by controversy. A, what happened? And B, who scored our goals that day?
Well, we'll say that what happened, it was just Phil Prosser, and I think everything else is answered by itself. Who scored for us that day? I know we went 2-0 up. I would say... Are we back to Dean Hammond again?
No, it wasn't Dean Hammond, no.
Yeah, it was 2002, so it must have been Vergs, surely.
No, it wasn't, no.
Go on, Justin. I can only go through the whole team once here.
Bobby.
No, because he was injured at the time.
No, Bobby played in that game.
Was he? Chris McPhee.
It was one of the players. I think it was his only goal for us. I need to check that, but he certainly didn't score many. And the other one...
Alexis Nicholas.
A perennial favourite...
Nicky Forster. No. We're just going to name the entire With Dean alumni if you carry this on, mate.
Yes. Gary. Gary Hart. It was Gary Hart. And Graham Barrett was the other one, Al. So I actually looked up to see what happened to him. He did not have a good career. He ended up in the lower leagues in Scotland, in case you were wondering. But I mean, it was... But the, the, those games, I mean, Sheffield United...
How could you not mention, if you're going to ask questions, how could you not mention the 5-4 game at Bramall Lane? How could you not? When Bob Booker scored for them too many times. They went 3-0 down, 4-3 up, and then they lost 5-4.
Because that was too obvious, Al. But anyway, I was saving you some for the Renth quiz, Al. You've got to know about these things. Come on. Give me a break here. Anyway, it was, I mean, our record against them isn't that great, though. I mean, we've only actually played them in our history 28 times, including that 5-4 at Bramall Lane there, which was in the FA Cup, I believe. We've won 9, drawn 6, and lost 13.
Well, to be honest, Sheffield United have always been a bigger club than us in the times that... Well, the reason we didn't play them for so many years is that they were either in the first or second division while we were plummeting around the Division 3 South. It's just in the 70s and 80s that they spent too much time in the fourth division. When I say too much time for a club of that size. Mm. Them and Wolves and a few others, they were bumping around the bottom reaches for far too long. They are a big club. I find their fans a smidge less obnoxious than the Sheffield Wednesday fans, but sadly that isn't saying a huge amount.
I wonder where you're going to go there.
Yeah.
But they've got some good big names in their fanship.
And actually, if you're gonna take a real good historical point here, it was actually indirectly through Sheffield United that Tottenham managed to secure the services of Villa and Ardiles. But that's a story that's too long to tell on this show.
They nearly signed Diego Maradona at one point as well.
Yeah, I know. They had a lot of links. Well, they had a lot of links. Harry Haslam, who was the Sheffield United chairman, had a lot of business links in Argentina. Realised that Ardiles was available, but just couldn't afford him. I mean, this was one of the players of the 78 World Cup. I think he was friends with Irving Scholar, who was the chairman of Spurs at the time. And said, well, you know, there's a couple of players I want to go. Well, sorry, there's a player who reckon can go over here, but Ardiles would only come over if his mate Ricardo would come with him.
True.
So,
very true.
As someone who actually then reported at the time, he said it's a bit like bloke going into Fads for some paint and coming out with a Canaletto.
Well, there you go.
Cultural reference idea. I won't be surprised if you don't get it.
It's a shame they didn't pull off that trick with Tevez and Mascherano, because that led to their... inevitable relegation.
Yes.
And
absolutely.
Well, just quickly, just before we close, there has been some other news this week. Well, a story about possible changes to the offside rule. It does need changing. It can't go on in the
It's not so much it doesn't need changing. I think it's perfectly satisfactory, but it's actually how it's being administered. And how it's been administered is an absolute farce. You know, these lines in the pitch. Sorry, level is level. I know what you're saying here. We're talking about Arsene Wenger's idea about... It's quite tricky to explain, but it's along the lines of if you're...
He's basically said you won't be offside if any part of your body that can score a goal is in line with the last defender.
So. Yeah, as opposed to now where if any... It's basically giving the right of way to the forward rather than defender. If your big toe's just ahead of the last defender, you're offside at the moment. What they're saying is your back of your heel could be level with the defender and you'll be onside. It's an interesting idea. IFAB aren't interested at the moment. It's not on their agenda. And if it's going to happen, it won't happen until their agenda, their AGM, which will be this time next year.
Well, I mean, the technology with offside isn't accurate enough at the moment because of the things like frame rate. And things like that Wolves offside with the heel, that when the ball was played and when the heel was there, they cannot possibly know how that's going to be, how that could possibly be.
Are you enjoying VAR?
I hate it. The offsides are... It's just a bit of a joke. The Burn goal against Bournemouth was particularly frustrating. But, yeah, it's going down to such fine details. They don't seem to go down to that level of detail when the ball leaves the player kind of passing the ball to prior to the goal-scoring chance. So, it's all over the place.
Just drives you around the twist.
And that's all we've got time for. So thank you very much to Justin Brentnell. Thanks very much to Alan Wares. Thanks to Di Cunningham. I've been Ailey Packham. This has been the Albion Roar in association with oldfootballshirts.com. But if you want to sponsor us for the Reverbathon, please contact us at thealbionroar.co.uk. We'll be back next week. Big game then. Crystal Palace. See you then. Bye.
The British police are the best in the world. don't believe one of these stories I've heard about them raiding our pubs for no reason at all, lining the customers up by the wall, picking out people, knocking them down, resisting arrest as they're kicked on the ground, searching their houses, calling them queer. I don't believe that sort of thing happens here. Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way. Hey, sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way. Pictures of naked young women are fun in tidbits of Playboy, page 3 of the Sun. There's no nudes in Gay News or One magazine, but they still found excuses to call it obscene. Read how disgusting we are in the press, the Telegraph, People and Sunday Express. Molesters of children, corrupters of youth, it's there in the paper, it must be the truth. Try and sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way. Hey, sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way. Don't try to kid us that if you're discreet, you're perfectly safe as you walk down the street. You don't have to mince or make bitchy remarks to get beaten unconscious and left in the dark. I had a friend who was gentle and short. He was lonely one evening, he went for a walk. Queer bashers caught him, kicked in his teeth, was only hospitalized for a week, and he still bears the scars. Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way. Hey, sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way. And sit back and watch as they close down our clubs, arrest us for meeting and raid all our pubs. Make sure your boyfriend's at least 21, so only your friends and your brothers get done. Lie to your workmates, lie to your folks, put down the Queen's, tell anti-queer jokes. Gay lives ridiculous, join their laughter. The buggers are legal now, what more are they after? Tell them. To be gay, sing if you're happy that way. Hey, sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way. Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way.